today on the Run to the Top podcast.
I mean, years ago, people used to ask me what I did for a living, and I would mumble that I'm a race director. You know, like, what is that? What do you do? Chalk mark in the road and yell go? Back then, that's sort of what it was. And now when people say to me, what do I do for a living? I help raise the level of self-esteem and self-confidence of tens of thousands of people in America.
Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast from Runners Connect, where it's all about learning from the best and most inspiring minds in the sport. Together, we can train a smarter, healthier, and faster running community. Now here's your host, Sinead Hockey.
Hi everybody, this is your host Sinead Hockey, here with you for this latest episode of Run to the Top, brought to you by Runners Connect. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope you're having a great day or a great run if you happen to be out running right now. Last week we spoke with Chris Case, Dr. John Mandrola, and Leonard Zinn, who together make up the authors of The Haywire Heart. This is the first book ever to study heart conditions in endurance athletes, and I've got to say there is some pretty enlightening information in there on the consequences of exercising too much. I really think we runners tend to ride that line between just right and too much more often than not. And so according to Dr. Mandrola, studies are really starting to show how badly this can affect your heart. I'll be frank, this is not an episode you should skip. So if you missed it, be sure to check it out and get some more information on athlete's heart and how to protect your heart against it. This was a fantastic book that I would recommend to anyone. So if you are interested, be sure to check out The Haywire Heart through the link below. Runners Connect members, don't forget we currently have a 20% discount going with VeloPress, so be sure to follow the link below to use that at checkout when you buy The Haywire Heart. So this week we're speaking to Dave McGilvery, the man behind what is arguably the most iconic road race in the world, the Boston Marathon. Dave will be celebrating his 30th year as the director of Boston this April 17th, and in those 30 years, I think it's safe to say he's really turned this race into almost a rite of passage for runners. Since he began directing in 1987, Boston has come from just over 6,000 entrants to nearly 31,000 just last year. And it's getting harder and harder to qualify for, which I think is part of its appeal among runners. Dave is also the director of a number of other prestigious road races through his company, Dave McGilvery Sports Enterprises, including the Beach to Beacon 10K and the New Balance Falmouth Road Race, which I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with. So something I'll admit I didn't know about Dave before reading up on him was just how much charitable work he has done throughout his life. This guy is a big philanthropist, and he actually kind of pioneered the entire notion of running for charity, which is why a lot of people participate in road racing today. The Boston Marathon alone has raised more than $264 million since 1989. And if you think that's impressive, I think you're really going to enjoy hearing about Dave's other acts of charity, which I'm sure he could probably talk about for hours. That said, I do want to make sure we have enough time to get to Dave's athletic career as well, because he is quite an accomplished athlete. Dave has competed in 9 Ironman triathlons and 144 marathons. You heard that right, 144, and 44 of those were the Boston Marathon itself. I know a lot of our listeners are getting ready to run Boston in just a week and a half here, so I'm really excited for this episode. Just to warn you, Dave did have to run to a meeting towards the end of this interview, so unfortunately we had to end a little bit abruptly. Needless to say, Dave is incredibly busy right now with the marathon coming up so soon, so I really do appreciate him taking the time to sit down with us. So without further ado, we'll jump right into this after a quick word from our sponsors. I want to give a big thank you to Body Health for sponsoring Run to the Top and for giving me the building blocks needed to train harder and feel better doing it. You can enter to win a pack of 6 Perfect Amino bottles for free by visiting runnersconnect.net/body health. Thank you so much to Pacific Health Labs for sponsoring Run to the Top and giving runners what we need to train as efficiently as possible. Be sure to check out the Endurox R4 recovery drink for quicker recovery and muscle restoration at runnersconnect.net/Pacific Health. Welcome to Run to the Top, Dave.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
I'm so excited to have you on. I know this is a very busy time for you with Boston and just a few weeks here, so really appreciate you coming on today.
Yeah, not a problem. My pleasure.
So a lot of our listeners and a lot of our members at Runners Connect are either running Boston this year or they're working hard to qualify in the future. So I'm sure they're very excited to hear from you and, you know, learn a little bit about you today. You've done a lot even outside of your years with the Boston Marathon. So, you know, I don't want to waste too much time here. I think we've got a lot to cover in a very short time. So could you just share a little bit about your running background with us?
Sure. I grew up in a city right outside of Boston, Medford, Mass. And when I was a kid, my whole number one thing in life was to be an athlete, but I was short in stature. I kept getting cut from the teams or when my friends bucked up for sides, you know, in the playgrounds, I was always the last one picked. Hence, I wrote a book called The Last Pick. And so by default, I started running because nobody can cut you from running. You just go run. And I started making that sort of my path towards athleticism. And you know, I started running things like my age on my birthday. 1978, I ran across the United States from Medford, Oregon to my hometown of Medford, Mass. 3,452 miles in 80 days. And then I ran up the East Coast of America following that. And then I got myself involved in triathlons. And I did the 1980 Ironman Triathlon World Championship in Hawaii. And then I did it again in 83, 84, 85, 86, 87, 88, and 89. So I did it 8 times in the 1980s. And then I continued just to do a bunch of athletic things, swam for 24 hours, bike for 24 hours, and started running more marathons. And I guess, as they say, the rest is history in terms of my running. So it's in my DNA, obviously very passionate about it. And lucky for me, I was able to create a vocation out of my quasi-hobby, if you will. And now I'm on both sides of the fence. I run in races and I run races. So I get to see it from both sides.
That's amazing. And I do want to touch on some of your charity work. You kind of talked about that a little bit with, you know, all these 24-hour runs you just talked about, but we'll get to that in a few minutes here. What would you say kind of sparked your love for long-distance running?
Again, I think it was more a matter of I knew I wasn't swift of foot like a sprinter or a middle-distance runner or even a marathoner. I did fairly well. My PR is in the 229, but I was never right up there at the top. But I always had an endurance capacity, and I knew that. And so that's why I wanted to challenge myself. But I also wanted to make sure that I didn't recklessly set these goals, that I earned the right to do them. So that's why in 1978, I decided to run across the United States because, you know, a friend of mine had biked across, and I thought if he can bike across, I can run across. But I also knew at the time that I needed more reason for doing it, a greater purpose. And I hooked up with the Jimmy Fund of Boston, which is the fundraising arm of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And I went and I saw the kids who were being treated at the Jimmy Fund. And I knew at the time that the battle that I was about to fight by running over 5.5 million footsteps across America was in no way as difficult as the battle that these kids are fighting for their own life. And I remember seeing a sign in the Jimmy Fund clinic. It said, God made only so many perfect heads. The rest of them have hair on it. And it just gave me pause and made me realize that these kids have a lot of courage and they're the true heroes and they believe in that we're going to help them get better. So I just knew as I was running across America, going through 120 degrees in the desert or running over the Rocky Mountains or running 50, 60 miles a day, even though that might have been somewhat painful, it paled in comparison to what these kids were going through. And so we raised a lot of money. I finished that run on August 29th, 1978 in Fenway Park in Boston in front of 35,000 people. And that's what just sort of started my philanthropic career, too. I think Runner's World had mentioned that run, raising money for a charitable organization, was the first time anyone had combined running and raising money for cancer research. So that was pretty interesting. I didn't realize it at the time, but and Obviously, now so many races are raising so much money. Just the Boston Marathon alone, with all the different charities involved, raises over $30 million a year. So it's great that philanthropy has entered the space and people are getting off the couch, if not for themselves, for another reason, giving back. But that's then getting them to the starting line, and they get themselves to the finish line, and then they're in it for life. And if it wasn't for these causes that are motivating them to do it, maybe they wouldn't ever have even started. So everyone benefits as a result.
I really love that. I think what you've done, you've done so many incredible runs and swims for charities, and it's very selfless of you. And I think you've got a point there that people enjoy, running for something bigger than themselves. So that's definitely a catalyst for a lot of people to get into running and kind of gets them off the couch, like you said. But I was looking at all of your different charity runs that you've done, and some of the ones that really stood out to me, the one you just talked about, obviously, was, your run across America from Medford, Oregon to Medford, Massachusetts. And just to put that in perspective for our listeners, that is 3,452 miles that you ran. And that's mm-hmm. amazing. I feel like you've done so much in your life just through these charity runs alone. One other one that really stood out to me was in 1986, you formed the first sanctioned running club inside a maximum security institution. And, mm-hmm. You conducted and ran numerous distance races inside the prison yard, including a marathon. Can you just talk a little bit about that one?
Yeah, I had been asked to come in to run against the inmates, and I figured, well, you only live once, and hopefully my life isn't going to end anytime too soon, but I'll give it a shot. And I went in, and they built that dirt track around the inside of the prison yard. It was about a half a mile in length. So this race that they invited me to run against the inmates was about a 10K, give or take. And, we took off, and the one thing on my mind myself that I do was to win, because I didn't think that they would like that someone came from the outside who had all the opportunities in the world to run on the road, open roads and everything else, came in and kind of dissed them in front of their other inmate friends watching this. But the long and short of it all is that I did end up winning that race, and they befriended me. And that's when I decided to form the running club and go back in and put on other races. And what was interesting is that it really started developing, and a lot of friends of mine would come up to me and say, "Why are you helping those criminals?" And I said, "Well, my theory is this, that some of these folks are going to get out someday, and I'd rather have them a little bit better on the way out than they were on the way in." And I said, "I'm only teaching them how to run, but what that has given them is something they didn't have, and which probably is the reason why they're in there to begin with, and that is self-esteem and self-confidence. Because without that, you can't accomplish anything in your life. And unfortunately, some people just get caught up in with the wrong crowd or whatever it might be. And there are those of us who are lucky enough to have a strong support team around us that can help pull us out of the quicksand if we ever fall in. So that's what I did at the prison yard. And it really made quite a difference, and it was a great experience.
That's great. I think you just said something very that I liked a lot there, that I think running kind of gives people kind of do running for a lot of different reasons, but it gives them something to, kind of focus on, and really something that betters themselves, whether it be physically or mentally. So I really like that you kind of pioneered, that movement in running clubs and maximum security prisons. So that was one of the more interesting charities I kind of saw when I was looking at your resume there, your very lengthy resume. Yeah. And, I would ask you to talk more on your charities, but I feel like we'd be here all day. You've done so much especially for the Jimmy Fund. One more I wanted to touch on just for our listeners was your 24-hour swim that you did in 1983. And, this was in an Olympic-sized swimming pool at Medford High School. You totaled what was it, 1,884 lengths, which I guess that equals that to a marathon. Yeah. So how was that experience for you?
Well, you know, swimming is not my forte like running is, but I had done a number of triathlons, so I had some degree of experience with it. And plus, one of my next goals was to possibly go over and swim the English Channel. So I was swimming a lot, and then I thought, well, this would be kind of an interesting thing. I had done a 24-hour run, and I thought, maybe I'll do a 24-hour swim someday, and I'll do a 24-hour bike ride someday. So I put that all together, and I said, okay, I'm going to do this. So that's exactly what I did. And obviously, doing it in a pool gets kind of monotonous and boring, but you have to have the mental discipline and know why you're doing it, and just focus on the reason for doing it and the accomplishment after the fact. So it ended up being something that just continued to drive me to set new goals. People, especially kids, ask me all the time, "What's your best accomplishment?" And I invariably say to them, "My best accomplishment is my next one," because I don't want to live off the past. I don't want to live off the accomplishments from the past. I want to use those as a level of confidence to build a foundation of confidence and then move forward and set new and, more interesting ideas and goals. So that's how I live my life, the thing I have been doing since I was 12 is running my age on my birthday. So when I was 12, I ran 12 miles, 13 miles, 14 miles, and I'm 62 now. And, run 62 miles on your 62nd birthday. People say to me, "Well, what are you going to do when you turn 90? And my response is, "Well, it's my game, so it's my rules. I can just change the rules. And, I don't have to go by what someone else is saying or thinking I should or shouldn't do." So I've been able to sort of chip away and get things accomplished with that kind of a philosophy and attitude.
That's awesome. I did remember reading that you run your age every year and was wondering how long you plan to keep that up. But I like how you just said that, it's your game and it's your rules. So I think this can kind of be applied to a lot of our listeners many of our listeners are masters runners. A lot of our demographic at Runners Connect is, 40 to 60 years old. And I feel like they are often very good at making their own rules in regards to running. A lot of them know that while they might not run as fast as they might have when they were 20 years old, they know that, they are going to set their sights on a new goal every day. And that's what I really like about our members at Runners Connect. But I think it's good for them to hear you say that as well. So I love all of your charity work. You've done so much for the Jimmy Fund and for so many countless other people. I did want to ask you, since you've been around in the running scene, either both as a runner and as a race director since the 70s and 80s, how do you feel running has evolved since that time?
Back in the 70s, it was more of a sport in terms of the competitive nature of it. And the only ones doing it were those people who just wanted to, be a factor at the finish line. And so there weren't that many of us. You go to a race, you'd have 300-400 people. Now you go to a race that has 30,000 people. So the walls of intimidation crumbled in the 80s and 90s. And again, philanthropy entered the space and people were doing it for a greater purpose. And people were getting off the couch and said, "Hey, I can do this now." And so I think we're in a great place right now, because I think on the front end, it's still very competitive. Obviously, throughout the field, it's competitive, too, with age group competition. But the majority of people are doing it for a different reason than to reach the finish line faster than someone else their age. It's the health and fitness benefits, the charitable benefits, the whole concept of getting in the game themselves instead of being a spectator. I mean, years ago, people used to ask me what I did for a living, and I would mumble that I'm a race director. They were like, "What is that? What do you do? Chalk mark in the road and yell go?" Back then, that's sort of what it was. At least that's what we thought it was. And now when people say to me, "What do I do for a living?" I say, "I help raise the level of self-esteem and self confidence of tens of thousands of people in America. And that's truly what we do as event producers. We give people an opportunity to feel good about themselves. You know, the toughest part about running a race is signing the application, is having the guts to make the commitment. And then you have to do the work. And then you, you know, you toe the line and you run the race and you get your medal and magic happens. You go home feeling good about yourself. And nothing in this world can be better for somebody to at least have a level of self-esteem and self-confidence that they can use that to achieve other things. So that's what, in my opinion, this sport now does.
Absolutely. And I feel like you have kind of pioneered that. You know, you are the race director of Boston Marathon. I think that's one of the most iconic road races in the world. And part of the reason I think it is because you just, like you said, you have that, all that camaraderie, just that atmosphere that is so unique to Boston. And, you know, I feel like you've really contributed to making running a platform for a lot of different things. And, you know, back in the 70s, I feel like there was maybe a slightly bigger pool of elite runners, but now it has kind of evolved into, you know, there are just a lot more kind of general interest in running than there might have been back then. Is that kind of what you would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's a correct statement. Again, everyone has their own reasons for doing this, but I think that, you know, there's social reasons for doing it. There's health and fitness reasons for doing it. There's inspirational reasons for doing it. So everyone is driven by a different drum here. But at the end of the day, you know, we're all getting a lot more out of it than we're probably even putting into it. So that's the beauty of this industry. And that's why races are selling out at record pace now. It's sometimes the toughest part of my job is turning people away from races that fill up at record pace. It's frustrating to have to turn away business, but there's a lot more demand than there is supply sometimes.
Definitely. And I think Boston has become almost a rite of passage among runners. And I think obviously it's becoming harder and harder to qualify for Boston, given there's that high demand. Do you feel that all races should be like this, should have a qualifying standard?
Not all races, no, although I have a somewhat of a different take than most people on running a marathon. I think it's wonderful that people set that as a goal and go out and do some work and then run in a marathon. But I also think that, you know, they have to think about the people out there managing it too, and all the volunteers and everyone else. And sometimes people kind of take a long time now. Some might run and walk it or walk a lot of it and take an inordinate amount of time, 6, 7, 8 hours or whatever it might be. And God bless them for doing that, but it does tax the resources involved. And I think that you shouldn't really set that as a goal until you've earned the right to do it. I think that everyone almost should be required to first do a half marathon, maybe under a certain time, like under 3 hours, something fairly judicious. But just to say, okay, I've been there. I've done some of the work. I've experienced this, not just jump into a marathon on a barroom bet. So on the one hand, I like the fact that races are open to anybody who wants to run. But on the other hand, races that might be a little bit longer and more strenuous, maybe there should be some parameters that people have to meet in order to toe the starting line.
I definitely agree. At Runners Connect, we have most of our members run the marathon, but you know, the marathon is its own monster, so we always advise they do a tune-up race with a half marathon or something like that, just to maybe give them a little baby step into the marathon. But I definitely agree with what you just said there. I think the marathon is definitely a monster in and of itself, and that you need to go into it prepared and not kind of as a barroom bet, as you just said.
Mm-hmm.
So I know you direct a lot of other races outside of Boston under your firm DMSE, and these include some of our listeners would be very familiar with our Beach to Beacon 10K, the New Balance Falmouth Road Race, all the women's half marathon series throughout the U.S. So can you describe in a nutshell, you know, what it means to be a race director? You were just talking about how, you know, you feel like you make a great impact on people's lives, and you definitely do. But what does your job entail that most people probably wouldn't know about?
You know, obviously, it's very labor intensive. You know, initially it starts with vision and conceptualization, and then it's about all the planning that goes into it, designing the courses and getting the permission and looking for sponsorship, and then all the administrative work with the website and online registration and building your committee, your organizing committee of all the people that need to come together to help, you know, produce the event. There's a lot more that goes into it and probably meets the eye. You know, I have a button in my office that says, "My job secure, no one else wants it." I mean, even though I love what I do and I'm passionate about it, I also realize that there's a lot on the line these days. There's a lot of money involved with sponsors and entry fee revenue. And there's a lot of media and press involved. There's, you know, athletes train for a long time to participate in your race. So there's a lot at stake. They write a check. You have to give them a return for their investment. It's all about quality versus quantity. You know, God forbid there's issues, medical issues in your race, and you have to deal with all of those. The whole industry has changed over the years with medical, with technology. The races that are doing well now are the ones that have the most toys, you know, whether that's tracking or whatever it might be. It just seems like technology has really been the thing that has separated one race from the other now. And of course, security, given what happened in Boston in 2013, every race has raised their level of security fivefold or tenfold. And in as much as that's necessarily needed, and I totally support it, it's unfortunate. There's a lot of resources and a lot of inconveniences now are attached to all our events that in the past didn't exist, but we have to be vigilant, and we have to make sure our races and our venues and everyone involved are safe. So it's a new normal. It's a whole new industry now.
Yeah, definitely. So you were just kind of talking about how you've had to increase security since 2013, obviously. How else has your approach to organizing the Boston Marathon changed since that year?
Well, just, you know, a focus on just making sure everyone's safe. So everything and anything you do, you have to keep that in the forefront. And, you know, just gear check bags, for example. We used to allow athletes to get on a bus and be transported out to the start and take a bag with them and then put their clothing in the bag and put it back on the bus, and the bus transport the bag to the finish. And when they cross the finish line, they just go to that same bus and get their bag. Well, that's all gone now. No transport of any bags, period. You know, so a whole bunch of situations like that have changed as a result. And so the runners and race management have had to learn a whole new system. And sometimes people have a tough time with change. But eventually, after a year or two, it's not change anymore. It's become the norm. So now we're 4 years out from then. And, you know, I think things are settling in and people are feeling comfortable with all the new systems and plans and the way we do business. And I feel we're in a good place right now.
That's great. I feel like since that year, ironically, I feel like the Boston Marathon has become more popular through the Boston Strong movement. Would you say that the atmosphere of the race has changed a little bit?
The atmosphere of everything? I think, you know, it was always, you know, a family-friendly, fun day. A little of that innocence was stolen from us. But I think people now have recovered from that. And it's back to the competition in the event. We'll never forget, you know, those people who were profoundly impacted. But at the same time, we do have a race to run, and we owe it to our participants to put on a quality event. So we have to remain focused on that. And I think we have. And I think, you know, the spirit from all the people who, you know, realize that good will always overcome evil has certainly been infectious for everybody. So I think the strength in the spirit is as high as it's ever been. And I don't see in the foreseeable future how that's not going to continue.
Absolutely. I feel like kind of what you were just saying there, I think the running community is probably the strongest and most close-knit in the world. So, you know, I think it would take a lot to disrupt that camaraderie in running. Obviously, you've had to increase your security measures for Boston. What else, you know, what are some other big challenges you face as a race director, even just with your other races, and how do you deal with those?
I've been at it for a long time, so it's not like there's a lot of new things that come at me. I think the biggest challenge is probably the weather, dealing with the extreme weather, and mainly because field sizes now are so enormous. I mean, if you had a 200-person race, to kind of get them all under cover if there's a threat of lightning is not too difficult to do. But if you got a field size of 30,000 and there's a threat of lightning, where are you going to put all these people? So just because of the magnitude of these events now, you know, obviously the level of responsibility has exponentially grown. And so when you take on the responsibility of accepting that many people, you better be in a position to have enough resources to deal with those crises management, crises contingency moments that we all experience at one time or another, you know, whether it's a fire on the course or whether it's, you know, some kind of weather situation, heat or snow or rain or wind or lightning or whatever it might end up being. You really need to be on your toes. You know, for me, I'm always of the attitude that I'd rather not put out fires. I'd rather prevent them. And so to prevent things from going wrong, you got to do an awful lot of planning behind the scenes, way more than just plan A. You got to play the devil's advocate. What if, what if, what if, and have all these things in place to make sure that those things don't happen. And if they do, you've already worked through what the chain of command is and how you're going to deal with them. And we spend a lot of time doing those kind of tabletop exercises and to prepare us for anything that might come our way.
Definitely. I feel like there are so many different components that you were just talking about in race directing that maybe people aren't aware of. And, you know, you've got to plan ahead, like you said, make sure that everything is taken care of, all the bases are covered before race day. So kind of going off that, we'll go for maybe a lighter note here. What would you say is the best part about your job?
Doing interviews like this with you. I'm being a little bit tongue in cheek, but I'm also being serious that, you know, getting to be being able to share experiences with people. And for me, it isn't about keeping things close to the vest. It's a small industry, and I always like to share best practices with fellow race directors. I like to solicit feedback from the participants. My whole MO is always to improve. You know, you'll never put on the perfect event, but, you know, each time you chip away and put things under a microscope, maybe you can come closer and closer to it. So, you know, obviously, what I truly like the most is, you know, when people say to me that they had a great experience, they had a lot of fun. Some of them, this was a life-changing experience. I mean, some of the feedback can just blow you away. So it's very rewarding. It's not as much the paycheck as it is, you know, the attaboys that mean the most.
Well, you've definitely done a tremendous job with the Boston Marathon for, you know, is this your 30th year doing this now?
Yeah.
So, you know, I feel like, again, you've really done a tremendous job with this. I like that you enjoy participating as well, that you, you know, really thrive on making a relationship with each and every runner. So I know that you run the course every year after you are done directing. How do you will yourself to do that mentally and physically after such a stressful day?
Well, when I started it 30 years ago, so I was a lot younger, you know, cranking that out then was, I don't know, sort of just academic. But now as I get older, you know, I keep hitting my forehead saying, why did I even start this? But I truly look forward to it every year. It's calm after the storm. I train hard like everyone. I'm training right now for that World Marathon Challenge, which is a marathon since days. I'm headed in that January. So this I had set aside this week 3 months ago to simulate a little bit. So on Sunday, I went out and ran a marathon. On Monday, I ran a marathon. On Tuesday, I ran a marathon. Today, I ran a half. Tomorrow, I run half. Friday, I run half. And Saturday, I'll finish up and run the Boston Marathon course. That'll be 4 marathons and 3 half marathons in 7 days.
Oh, my gosh.
So for me, you know, I just like challenging myself. I don't like doing it recklessly. I know where I'm at. I know what shape I'm in. I know what pace I should or shouldn't go out at. So when I do the marathon at night, yeah, it's I'm not going to go set a PR, but you know, I always, like I said at the beginning, I want to be an athlete. I like race directing. I'd rather be an athlete. So for me, I can do both. I can direct the race during the day and run the course at night. You know, I've been the last finisher for the last 29 years, but I'm good. I'm good with that.
So that's amazing. I'm kind of surprised that you found time to do this interview with me today, given have you already run your half marathon today?
Yeah, I did it this morning.
Oh my gosh. That's remarkable. So how, you know, a lot of our listeners are kind of starting out a little bit later in the game. They're trying to, you know, maybe better themselves physically. How have you managed to remain fit and competitive over the years?
I think you just have to stay in tune with your body. I mean, it may sound a little silly, but we all can recognize when you feel good and when you're not feeling good. And when you're not, you got to back off or you got to go get it fixed. You know, maintenance and recovery is as important, if not more, than the work. So it's just having a innate sense for taking care of yourself all around the board. You know, a few years ago, I was diagnosed with severe coronary artery disease. I didn't know I had that. And I was having some difficulty breathing when I was starting my run. So I went and got checked and that's what they found. And the long and short of it all is it's genetics. You know, a lot of that's my family history. But I made some changes in diet and stress level and sleep habits. And I was breaking some of the rules, trying to get more out of every day than I probably should have. But as a result, I reversed my own severe coronary artery disease in the last 2 years by over 50% without even any medication, because I just started paying a little bit more attention. And I think everyone can do the same thing, but they just have to want to do it. So.
So have you had to alter your training at all since then, or have you just altered kind of other areas of your lifestyle, like you said?
Yeah, other areas. My training probably hasn't changed too much. As long as, you know, I get under control and I'm okay. You know, if I start feeling I'm having trouble breathing again, then I'm going to have to adjust and back off and make some more changes. But so far, so good.
That's amazing. So how many times have you run the Boston Marathon at this point? Is it 45? Will this be your 45th?
Yeah, this will be 45 total and 30 at night.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so we're just going to take a minute here and thank our sponsors for sponsoring this podcast, and then we'll come right back for the final kick. We runners ask a lot of our bodies, so it's important we equip them properly, both inside and out. When I started preparing for my first half marathon, I was training harder than ever and feeling it. I was having a really hard time recovering between runs and didn't seem to be getting a lot of return on all the supplemental stuff, like weightlifting and core work. That's why I decided to give Endurox a try, and I'm so glad I did. It's full of electrolytes, antioxidants, and L-glutamine, which helps to expedite recovery and muscle gain. This all-natural supplement is created by Pacific Health Labs, the very company that discovered that 30-minute recovery window we're all familiar with. Pacific Health has been at the forefront of research on fuel and recovery for endurance athletes for 20 years. Not just that, but they have more peer-reviewed science behind their formulation than any other on the market. That's because the people at Pacific Health genuinely want to give you that extra edge in training, so you can work harder while recovering faster. I absolutely love the Endurox R4 because it helps me get the most out of my workouts, but it honestly just tastes incredible too. While I would usually say chocolate is my favorite flavor, I just tried the banana cream flavor, and it's actually giving chocolate a run for its money, which is saying something. You'll just have to try it out for yourself, which you can do at runnersconnect.net/Pacific Health. And be sure to give Pacific Health your feedback. they're always looking for more ways to help you reach your goals. While we runners usually practice good, nutrient-dense diets, most of us lack the amino acids needed to break down and process the proteins we consume. This is bad news for both recovery and muscle growth, not to mention a ton of other vital life processes. That's why Body Health created Perfect Amino, the perfect blend of the 8 essential amino acids to help you build your muscles, expedite recovery, and nab that next personal record. I take Perfect Amino tablets every day and mix the Perfect Amino XP powder in my post-workout smoothies for extended protein absorption. This has helped me work harder and reach new levels in my running, something so important to the Body Health team that if you place in your age group at any public racing event, they'll put you in their winner's circle and send you a free bottle of Perfect Amino. Check it out at runnersconnect.net/winner-circle to learn more. And don't forget to use coupon code RUNNERSCONNECT on your next purchase. That's RUNNERSCONNECT in all caps. Make sure to also visit runnersconnect.net/bodyhealth, where you can enter to win a 6-pack of Perfect Amino worth $230. Again, that's runnersconnect.net/bodyhealth. I wish you the best of luck. Okay, we're back for the final kick. Dave, this is just a quick round of 5 questions, very simple, and looking forward to hearing your answers on these. First off, what is the greatest advice you've ever received?
My grandfather told me that you have to earn the right to do something. So I've lived by that my whole life. Marathon. I dropped in, I wasn't registered, 18 miles and dropped out. I was taken to the hospital in an ambulance. And then my grandfather said, you know, you got to train for this thing. And I said, yeah, you're right. And next year I trained and I was able to finish. I said, I'm going to run this race every year for the rest of my life. So that advice he gave me, earning the right, is always with me. And the other thing advice I've told is that wherever my car breaks down in this country, I'll be able to run home.
Oh, that's great. So I know you're very crunched for time here, so we'll keep going. But I think that's some advice that, you know, all of our listeners can definitely take note of and apply to their own lives. Next up, what is your favorite running book or blog?
A shameless plug of my own book called The Last Pick. And when people ask me what The Last Pick is about, I always say it's about the person reading it, because I believe that everyone has experienced similar things as I have, and that is overcoming adversity and trying to overcome hurdles that you face with from time to time. And then I'm writing a children's version of that book called Dream Big. And the intent of the book is just to inspire children to set goals and never to underestimate their own ability.
No, that's great. We're definitely going to link that first book you were talking about below, and we look forward to seeing your children's book as well. That's great that you're converting it into a book, you know, that children can enjoy as well. So next up, what would you tell a brand new runner?
Other than you sure you want to do this, mainly just to be patient. It's a virtue. And I think most people are impatient and they expect results immediately. And when they don't get them as quickly as they want, they abort or abandon the process. So Rome wasn't built in a day. It takes a while. It takes effort. And eventually you'll achieve your goal if you're willing to suffer the sacrifices involved in getting there.
Definitely. I think that's just the reality most runners have to accept, is that things don't happen overnight. You really have to work years and years at this to see improvements. So some great advice there. Fourth question, what is your pre-race meal?
Well, it depends on when the race is, if it's early morning or mid-morning or even noontime. So it varies from event to event. The main thing I try to pay attention to is I don't try to eat what I call heavy. I don't like to have a heavy gut at the start of a race. Everyone has theories on this. You know, you can read a lot of books on what you should or shouldn't do, eat or not eat, and when you should and when you shouldn't, but it's all trial and error. And you have to that's what training is all about, is learning your own body and what it responds to. So, you know, for me, it's different on different occasions. So But I think that that's a good rule to follow.
Definitely. I think, you know, eating before a race is very individual to everyone, like you said, and I'm more like you and I don't have an ironclad stomach, but I know people that do and can, you know, eat quite a bit before a race. So it's very individual, like you said. Our fifth and final question is, what is your favorite running product?
Okay, my favorite running product is something very different than probably what anyone else on the planet runs with. And that is, I run with a voice recorder, like a dictaphone. I don't run with a headset or anything like that. I run with a voice recorder, and I have done that for 35 years. Why do I do that? I do my best thinking out on the road. I come up with my best thoughts. I'm creative. There's no distractions. I think deep and really pull the best ideas out of my head when I'm out on the road. Well, I don't want to lose any of them. So as those ideas come to me, I just quickly record them on my voice recorder. And then when I get home, I write them down and then I tick them off as I go throughout the week and get things accomplished. So without that voice recorder, I probably would have only accomplished 50% of the things that I have, because it has actually saved me and saved all those good ideas. I've never missed one good one out on the road because I've been able to capture it.
That's fantastic. I've never heard of anyone doing that before, but I think most of us do some of our best thinking while we're out, you know, running those miles. So that's great. I've never heard of someone doing that before, but that's clearly worked for you, given you've led such a successful life. So, Dave, thank you so much for joining us. I again appreciate you taking the time out of your very busy schedule to join us. And I hope our listeners have enjoyed hearing from you. I know I have.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on. Take care. Bye-bye.
So I do apologize again for the sudden end to the interview there. This is where Dave had to run and catch a meeting, which, given the time of year, I completely understand. I think he might have had to talk to me on his phone as well, so I'm very sorry for the muffled audio here and there. As you just heard, there are a ton of components to directing a marathon that I think we tend to take for granted, so I'm honestly just so thankful Dave managed to fit this into his schedule with the big show just around the corner here. Needless to say, Dave has led a very full life, and I think it's pretty clear that his true passion is people. From helping those less fortunate to creating a platform onto which people may reach their athletic goals, Dave has truly impacted so many lives. He's a remarkable guy with a really fascinating story. One thing about Dave we didn't really get to talk about is his work as a writer, so if you're interested in learning a little bit more about Dave, be sure to check out his autobiography through the link below. So I really hope you've enjoyed getting to know Dave. I certainly have myself, and best of luck to everyone running Boston this year. If you're there, be sure to keep a lookout for Dave, and maybe even cheer him on that evening after the race when he'll be running the course for, I believe, the 45th time in a row. Next week, we'll be talking to leading sports physiologist and beet root expert Andrew Jones. Andrew has worked with a ton of elite athletes, and he was actually the longtime physiologist to marathon world record holder Paula Radcliffe. He also conducted the early research on beetroot as a natural performance enhancer, and he's pretty much responsible for beet juice's rise in popularity among runners over the past few years, so this should make for a very interesting episode. Definitely be sure to check it out next week. So before I wrap this up, I just want to give a big thank you to everyone who emailed me feedback over this last week. You have provided some great tips for me that I'm working to implement in these upcoming interviews to really improve on the quality. I really cannot thank you enough. I've been taking notes with each email I get, so if there is something you think of that I can improve on, please feel free to help me out and email me at hockey@runnersconnect.net. Again, that is hockey, HAUGHEY, at runnersconnect.net. I truly appreciate any feedback I can get, so thank you all so much for all the feedback I've gotten already, and I look forward to the emails to come. Thank you so much again for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I hope you have a fantastic week. Until next time.
Thanks for listening to the Run to the Top podcast from runnersconnect.net.